a very warm welcome to another North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group pod. We are on a roll this year. We have a whole range of exciting pods. So welcome to all of those who are our regular listeners, but also for those, if this is your first pod, please do go and have a look at our back catalogue. We've now got over 12 different podcasts that are available for you to listen to. So as usual, my name is Julie Jones and I'm joined as always with Helga McFarlane. And today we're going to be exploring a different part of the Parkinson's journey. We're looking at the very complex genetics and really in relation to that, how that element of Parkinson's research has been explored here in Scotland. And I suppose something that we're all very mindful of, understanding of what happens at a cellular level and in relation to genetics, has hugely changed in relation to Parkinson's. And really, you know, I think about when I first qualified, it was purely regarded as a basal ganglia disorder and that was it. And you had four symptoms or three really at that time. Whereas now actually with the fantastic work of researchers that we have here in Scotland and in the UK, really what we once thought is actually become a far larger condition. And it's, you know, from originally being considered as non-genetic to now that there seems to be quite a significant genetic contribution. So this is what we're going to look at today. So I'm going to hand over to Helga for a moment.
Well, research into the genetics of neurodegenerative diseases has taken today's guest all the way from the UK to the USA and back again. She's now based in Edinburgh. Dr. Kat Bowles is leading the investigation into a little-known gene which may play a role in the development of Parkinson's, and ultimately her work is aiming to deliver vital new knowledge in the quest to establish why some people do and others don't get the disease. Welcome, Catherine. It's lovely to have you with us today.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, we're delighted to have you on board today. And so I'm going to just start with a very nice big opener. And I suppose very mindful that our listeners can be very well informed, or this could be their first session that they're listening. I wonder if you could just give us an overview of a wider genetic picture in relation to Parkinson's and where we're at.
Oh, that is a very wide question. So, you know, I think it's important to distinguish that there are sort of two groups of genetic contribution to Parkinson's risk. So we've got a familial form of Parkinson's where there's a very clear genetic contribution. There might just be one gene, one variation in a gene that causes the disease, and that gets passed down through from parents to children. But then there are also sporadic cases of Parkinson's, right? So even though they're sporadic, it might not be passed down in the family. There is still a huge genetic component to that. But in that instance, instead of there just being one gene that is increasing your risk or causing the disease, there will be lots of genes with tiny effects that cumulatively and together with an interaction with the environment will change how likely you are to get the disorder. And I think that's really where my research is trying to put itself. You know, we're trying to understand the effect of these very kind of common genes and common variants that don't necessarily cause the disease, but they just change our risk.
Just going back over the last 20 years, has that really been the takeoff of the knowledge that we have now? And do you think we're still at the tip of the iceberg of what we really know about the genetic side of Parkinson's and other neurodegenerative diseases?
Yes. So, I mean, these genetic studies over the last 20 years are definitely becoming much more common. They're becoming absolutely enormous studies that are now including hundreds and thousands of people. And the bigger and bigger and bigger these studies are getting, the more and more and more genes we're identifying that have some kind of risk for Parkinson's or for Alzheimer's or for frontotemporal dementia. Because the bigger those studies are, the more powerful they are to find these very small effects. But saying that, there's kind of two trains of thought about kind of where we are with the genetics of these neurodegenerative disorders now. So there's kind of one train of thought where, you know, we've got to a point where these studies are so big and we've discovered so many genes with such small effects. Are they helpful anymore? You know, is it really helpful for us to identify a new genetic variant that only 1% of people have that only changes your risk by less than 1%? You know, in terms of developing a therapy, is that valuable. On the other hand, there's a train of thought where, you know, more is more. The more we know, the better it is. And there's definitely gaps in terms of what we know about genetics. It's not necessarily making these studies bigger and bigger, but, you know, there's gaps in terms of your genetic background or your ancestry. So, you know, quite embarrassingly, I think the vast majority of genetic studies are done in white European people. And there's a couple of large groups in East Asia. But other than that, what we know about genetics, not just for Parkinson's, but for anything really, is really very lacking. And so, you know, in terms of what the genetics is now telling us and where the gaps are, there's a lot more to do. So, you know, expanding to those diverse populations, what is shared between all people, what might just be in Europeans, what might just be in Africans. But what we really now need to do is understand what these genes do. You know, these enormous genetic studies will just nominate genes, but that doesn't help us unless we know what they're doing in the brain, and whether they're something that we can target new drugs towards, for example.
What always makes me curious is, what brought you to be researching this very specialised topic?
I didn't take a very straight path towards it, I suppose. So I started out, I did a psychology degree at university as an undergraduate. And I have to admit, I didn't really enjoy it very much. But what I did enjoy were the kind of the neuroscience modules and kind of things that were a lot more biology based. And so then I was, I'd like to say lucky, I suppose, lucky enough to get on a PhD program that was fairly new at the time, that integrated different areas of neuroscience and brain research together. So that let me jump from psychology over to genetics and biochemistry. Whereas I think if that kind of program wasn't available, that leap would have been harder for me to do. And so when I started my PhD, I was working on Huntington's disease. That's where I was exposed to doing cell culture, working on a molecular level, and I just fell in love with it. And then I, again, was lucky. I got a postdoc position in New York. That's where I was turned on to tau research. So things like progressive supranuclear palsy, frontotemporal dementia. And that's where I also got my training in genetics as well. And so I actually then came to Parkinson's research via tau genetics research. And there's a really interesting part of our genome that's incredibly complicated. It's the most interesting thing to study ever. but it's one of the regions, not only is it associated with all these different diseases that have tau accumulation, which is kind of, which are the diseases I was studying as a postdoc, but it's also associated with Parkinson's risk. And no one's really understood why this region should have anything to do with Parkinson's, because it should be something associated with tau, a different protein, different diseases. But so there was this study where we were trying to understand why that region had anything to do with Parkinson's risk. And through that study, we came up with, we identified this LERK37A2 gene, which is kind of the focus of what the project we're doing on the lab is now. And that is the kind of the segue into Parkinson's research. So not a direct route to get there, lots of twists and turns, but it's definitely fun now that we're there.
Well, I'm going to go rogue here and ask a question that isn't on the list, that Helga and I do interestingly prepare a list, but I'm going to go rogue. And so if this is a really difficult question, and I apologize, how do you name genes? So why do we have pink 1, pink 2, LLRK? Where do those names come from? Because for me, they're quite abstract and don't necessarily relate to the condition. So I'm sorry if that's a really complicated question, but I've always wanted to know.
Yeah, so there's a mix of reasons, right? It kind of depends when the gene was identified, by who, and in what context. So a lot of the time, they'll just be, you know, acronyms for a much longer, complicated name. So, for example, the gene that I'm studying, LERK37A, is LRRC37A. And then you also have LERK2, LRRK2. The LRR stands for leucine rich repeat. So it's describing the structure of the protein that comes from the gene. The K in LRRK2 would be kinase. So it's a description of what the function of that gene. But then you will have other ones which are named after maybe the context in which they were discovered. So Huntington's disease, for example, the gene is called Huntington because it was the gene for Huntington's, right? It's not a super leap of imagination. And then you have some scientists that think they're funny. So you've got genes like SHH, which stands for Sonic Hedgehog, because it helps things go faster. So it's there's a mix of reasons, but usually they're just acronyms for a long description of the function of what the gene does or what it looks like.
That's absolutely tremendous. I was thinking that it was every single one was intensely scientifically created. And no. I was thinking we were going to be going through the whole interview talking about LRRC3782. You've kind of answered the next question, but I'll ask you it anyway. Where does the gene that you're looking at sit within the ones that perhaps we're more familiar with hearing about in Parkinson's disease, like PINK1, PARKIN, LRRK2, and those ones?
Yeah, I think this is unfortunately going to be one of those answers where I say I don't know yet. So I refer to it as LRRK37A because LRRC, that I get confused saying that too. So it's a gene that's kind of, it's often referred to as the dark genome, right? So it's a region of the genome that's very complicated structurally. It gets normally filtered out of any of these big genetic studies that we were kind of talking about earlier. So because it's never been studied, it's never been associated with anything in any of these studies, right? So no one's had any reason to look at it before. So we have no idea what it does or what its role is. And so, you know, at the moment, I couldn't possibly say how it behaves in the context of other genes that have been associated with Parkinson's. We have a suspicion that it might have something to do with neuroinflammation and the way that cells are able to respond to synuclein, but that's based very much on preliminary data. And kind of the goal of the work we're going to do over the next couple of years is to figure out what this gene does. There's the potential for some overlap with LRRK2 function because they do both have that structural similarity with the lysine rich repeat. But saying that, there's loads of LRR genes throughout our genome and they all have very different functions. So we can't necessarily make that leap at this point in time. But one thing that is nice about this gene that maybe does distinguish it from the others is, you know, we found that having more of it is likely to be protective against risk for Parkinson's. Whereas, you know, what we typically study with all these other genes is something that is detrimental to health or sort of variants that are damaging to our health. So it's quite nice in this context that we can look at something that's good rather than that's damaging cells.
Can I ask you another basic question? You're mentioning there how people with Parkinson's don't have as much as people without, which you've established. Are they born like that? Or have they developed that? Perhaps has there been a viral trigger or an environmental trigger?
Yeah, so what we found is that the amount of LRRK37A2 that someone's cells are making is due to the number of the copies they have of that gene in their DNA. So if you imagine that, you know, our DNA is like an instruction manual for our cells, it tells them what to do, what to make. Every gene is a different instruction kind of in that list. For LRRK37A2, for some people, that instruction is copy-pasted over and over and over and over again. So the cell makes more of it because it's told to, right? So that means it's going to be a difference that people are born with because it's literally written in their DNA. So, you know, as I was saying, we don't know a great deal about this gene yet. So that's not to rule out that it can't change over somebody's lifetime. But, you know, the genetics is telling us that it's something you're born with, kind of this either having this risk or having this protection. But I would also like to point out that it's still a story about risk, not kind of cause or effect, right? So, you know, we found that people that had more LRRK37A2 were less likely to develop Parkinson's, but that didn't mean that people that had lots of copies never had Parkinson's, or people with few copies always had it. It's still kind of an interaction with the rest of our genome or interaction with the environment.
I think that was something that David Dexter mentioned in his talk that he did. I think with all the research that we're doing in Parkinson's, it's a bit like a jigsaw. And what he was saying, perhaps now with research, we've got the corners and we've got the edges. But things like your study, I think, is it's a bit of another piece of the jigsaw, that genetics is perhaps another element, but perhaps, as you say, it needs to be combined with environmental risks or other triggers that happen in society. But you can't really, in a research project, you can't control for them, because these can happen sporadically within the population at any given time. So it's just another piece of the jigsaw, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why we haven't got a solution to this yet is because it's really hard. and you know, there are so many pieces to it. I mean, Parkinson's especially, there is, you know, such an important environmental component to it as well. There's only so much we can model in cells and, you know, with the genetics that we do. But, you know, the hope is that that will tell us enough about what's happening in people's brains that we can maybe override or lessen the effects of the environment, like the things that we can't control.
So you've mentioned this a little bit already. So the study that you've been funded to look at this particular gene, so what is the objectives of this study? Is it just to look at the role of this gene and how it interacts with alpha-synuclein, or how, what happens, or its role in processing alpha-synuclein? Do you want to spend a bit of time telling us a bit more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I'd say it was even maybe one step before looking at alpha-synuclein necessarily. So, like I say, really, we don't know anything about this gene. I think when we published the paper, I think, you know, a year and a half ago, there were two papers ever that had looked at this gene. And they were in completely irrelevant cell types, right? So we really are starting from scratch here, which is kind of exciting, I suppose, as a researcher. So the initial goal is to just figure out what LUX87A does. So we're going to give cells more of it, we're going to take some of it away, and then we can see how the cells are then functioning differently. And so if we can see things that are boosted when we have more LUX87A, and those same things are kind of reduced when we take it away, we can then conclude, okay, LUX87A is regulating these processes in the cell. And we'll look at things that we see in our preliminary data. So things associated with inflammation primarily, right? We may look at the way cells are responding to synuclein, because that's something that we did see before. Then the next part of the project is to understand how that is affecting neuronal health. So, you know, we suspect LUX87A has a role in glial cells, so astrocytes specifically, but it's the neurons that are lost in people with Parkinson's. So the next part of the project is to see, well, if we change how much LUX87A astrocytes have, and then we grow them with neurons, how does that impact how healthy the neurons are? Can we save neurons from death or from stress if we give the astrocytes more LUX87A? So then the model starts becoming a bit more complicated and a bit more kind of looking at interactions between different cell types. So that's what the next couple of years are going to establish with this project. The next step would then be, can we take models of Parkinson's, so cell lines that have some of these variants in LRRK2 or PINK1 or Parkin or synuclein, and can we rescue the cell death and the stress that people see due to those mutations by increasing LRRK37A2? So that will then establish it as a potential route for developing a therapy if we can reverse some of the things associated with Parkinson's.
I think that's really important for people to sort of understand that timeline, because it's a bit like stem cell replacement therapy. When we're thinking about transplantation, you know, it takes about 8 years in that whole process. And I guess when we're dealing with what you're working on, you've already detailed there's a good 2 or 3 years where you're just working out what does it do, what is the impact, and if we change some of the variables, what impact does it have on this part of the cell or another part of a cell, or the waste disposal element of the cell. So really what we're looking at is this work in the lab is so important to provide that foundation before we even think about altering genes or gene replacement therapy or anything else in the future.
Yes, definitely. And I think actually, you know, it's one of the reasons why, you know, something like this podcast is so valuable, because I think from the outside, it can seem very much like science isn't progressing, that therapies aren't coming, that nothing's happening. But so much of it is, you know, there's all this effort kind of in the preliminary stages, right? Setting it up, as you say, getting that foundation and that baseline so that we can get something that will be effective and that will be valuable and will work. So yeah, it's a lot of work. We want to make sure that we get it right.
Yeah, and I suppose whatever therapy perhaps may or may not come out of your work is then that has to go through, as we've heard from other researchers, it has to go through sort of phase one, phase two, phase three trials. So again, for whatever therapy, there's that long lead in and before there might be a breakthrough. But it's because we're dealing with so many complicated elements. And I do think this is really insightful, because I recognize the frustration of people wanting a cure or a treatment, but it's really, really insightful to hear all these processes that have to happen. And I suppose from that perspective, you're doing all this in a lab. How can you talk us through what are the processes that you go through, some of the things that you do in a cellular function, and some of the tests or protocols that you have to do?
Oh, there's so many. There's so many things you can do. That's why it's such a fun job. So, I mean, it depends on what your research question is, right? What your hypothesis is. So my lab is focused on using iPS models, so induced pluripotent stem cell models of disease. So we take either blood cells or skin cells from people with Parkinson's, without Parkinson's, or maybe, you know, one of the tauopathies that we study. And then we can kind of revert them back to their stem cell state, where they have the capacity to become any cell in the body. And so, I mean, that's a process by itself. But then once you do that, you've got, you know, these iPSCs, you have to do lots of quality control to make sure that genetically they're normal, that they're growing correctly. And then we can use those and we can turn them into different types of brain cells. And so, you know, when I was talking about what we're doing with Lercvade 7A2 earlier, for example, we're doing that all in these iPSCs. We're going to turn the iPSCs into neurons, we'll turn them into astrocytes. And we can then change and modulate how much of a particular gene they express. We can introduce more copies, or we can use something called an siRNA, which will stop the cell from expressing it, stop that protein from being made. And then we can do lots of things like look at gene expression, we can do sequencing, we can look at how, you know, inflammation, how they're releasing different cytokines, how they might take up synuclein from the surrounding area. We can look at their morphology, their shape, their size, their survival. Oh, it's endless. Honestly, there's so many things. There's so many things you can do.
It blows my mind because these things are so small, and just the fact that how much you can manipulate them. And I think certainly for me, I'm a very visual person, so trying to see something is so important. And what you're talking about is things that are so small, and it's just amazing with our knowledge of science that we've worked out that we can even manipulate and change the function of a cell, which is really in itself so fascinating. But again, I suppose from that, there's quite a lot of processes which you've mentioned, but there's also the need to repeat those processes several times to make sure that it's not an anomaly, and to make sure that those tests can be repeatable and you're getting that standardization of process.
Definitely, yes. So there's, you know, checks and balances the whole way through. Nothing ever only gets repeated once. You know, you have to do it at an absolute bare minimum three times. With stem cell work as well, you're not just doing it on one line from one person, you'll have 3, 4, 5, 6 different lines from different people, all having different manipulations. You know, things that you're trying to demonstrate that are happening, you usually try and show at least two different ways or two different methods to say, to make sure that it's real and that you're not just measuring noise or artifacts. So I mean, like you get to clinical trial, right? It's quite rigorous to make sure that your effects are real. It's very much the same in basic science as well. You have to be very rigorous and make sure everything's very reproducible before we can say with any certainty that what we're seeing is real.
Absolutely. And I guess if we alter one cellular function, we also then need to think, and even if that's positive or what we were hoping for, we also need to identify if you change one thing, what were the ramifications on other cellular functions? So, and therefore the ability to metabolize that or process that or get rid of that is really, really important.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, the models that we're using are getting more and more complicated to reflect that. So, you know, for this project, we're starting off just in one cell type, just in the astrocytes, right? Then the next phase of the project is we're going to see how those astrocytes are interacting with neurons, because just changing astrocytes is going to affect how other cells function in the brain. The other, you know, model that we have in the lab are things called organoids. So that's where we're now moving into 3D cell culture. So things that are a little bit more similar to what the brain actually looks like. And so they're getting more and more complicated. You can see how different cells interact, how they're actually sort of moving in a 3D space. You know, and then as time and technology progresses, these models are getting more and more complicated and more advanced. It's really quite an exciting field at the moment, how quickly that's moving.
Wow. So I was just going to have a little bit of a gear change. So one of the questions that one of our listeners popped in was looking at some of the ethical considerations behind some of the research that you're doing at a very preliminary stage, but probably more so at the impact at the other end when we're looking at sort of editing genes. And perhaps there's people being considered around some of the ethical considerations. I wonder if you could put your thoughts on what those ethical considerations are and how we're trying to address it in the sort of research community to deal with that in the future.
It's such a tricky question. So I will sort of put a disclaimer on this first, is that, you know, I don't tend to come up against these things in my line of research. I'm, you know, my lab is very much in the basic science field, which makes it sound like it's really easy, but it just means that it's kind of, we're trying to understand how cells are functioning or dysfunctioning and kind of the molecular things that are happening that changes our brain health. We don't really do work that's directly translational, doing drug discovery or kind of around these things. So in the circles I run in, we don't tend to have these conversations. But, you know, I think it's a very tricky subject. I completely understand why it's fraught. There's a lot of progress, though, making towards it for a lot of these diseases where there's one single gene that's causing it, and it causes, you know, something throughout development and in childhood. So, for example, you know, it's had a positive impact for sickle cell disease. I think spinal muscular atrophy, muscular dystrophy, for example. It's been life saving for people. But I do think that, you know, for something that's a complicated kind of situation like Parkinson's, where there's many different genes, they all have very small effects. It's not a case of, oh, if you have this variant, you will get it. I don't see gene editing necessarily being the way forward because of all the ethical implications, right? So what gene would you target? Is there any reason to edit a gene if you don't know someone's even going to get the disease? When would you do it? Would it be at the age before they'd be symptomatic? Would you wait until after they're symptomatic? And then it wouldn't necessarily even do anything because the effect sizes are so small. So, you know, I think for the vast majority of people with these complex age-related disorders like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, gene editing is probably not going to be the solution. And for the very rare cases where there's a dominant mutation in one gene, that means you will definitely get it, then I think that's a different case. But I don't see how it would be terribly helpful for most people.
And I think it comes back to that, isn't it? The genetics is one part of a bigger puzzle, isn't it? And I think that's what, I think the more Pelga and I do these podcasts, I think that's what in some ways I find personally reassuring, and it'll be interesting to hear what Helga thinks. But you've got people at all stages and their research questions are quite different, but everybody's just contributing a tiny piece to the bigger puzzle. And we need to have all those pieces in place. And some can develop far quicker than others due to the nature of the research, whereas others are very much more complicated. And actually, perhaps we're also at some areas we're at that stage of learning more rather than are creating more questions as opposed to getting more answers. But that then itself maybe answers a question in another sphere. And I think that's why it's so important that researchers collaborate together, because actually people could be working in different fields, but perhaps there is some clicking in of two bits of jigsaw puzzle to answer a bigger question.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think gone are the days where it was just, you know, like one man in his basement laboratory making discoveries. We've done all the low hanging fruit has been picked. We're now nothing can be done by nothing really kind of high impact can really be done by one person by themselves, not talking to anybody. It's, you know, in every single field of research now, you have to collaborate, you have to communicate with people, work together. And I mean, honestly, that's a much more fun way of having, like, living your life and kind of doing this job rather than trying to, like, keep everything close to your chest. But yes, I think there's, I think the vast majority of people have come around to that being the way that we have to approach these questions now.
I think the biggest thing I've learned from doing these podcasts is seeing this link between it all. I mean, we have another podcast on diet, and we were talking about the link between the microbiome and the leaky gut and the transfer to the brain. So it is all one part of one huge complex picture. And you've done a fantastic job of explaining it, you know, in a level that I can understand. Julie is the knowledge and the brains of the podcast. I am the lay side of the podcast with a capital L, and I've understood it. And something it's made me also realize that the importance of, from a patient participation point of view, is the value of lay reviewers and lay summarizers. Because I have an intense interest in this, but without them, I would really struggle.
For me, has been quite unique through the process of applying to Parkinson's UK to kind of do this project is the involvement of the lay reviewers and kind of interacting with people with Parkinson's to kind of help put this proposal together. And we have plans as well to kind of develop a steering committee of people with Parkinson's and clinicians to kind of make sure that we're sticking to research that's most pertinent to their lives. That's really been very eye-opening for me. So, you know, every grant I've applied to, quite honestly, has a lay abstract that you need to write. But this is the first instance where a lay person's ever actually read it. and often they're just an afterthought, honestly, up until, you know, I've wrote this application. You know, you just kind of write your proposal and then you sort of try and write it in simpler terms. But I think it's been really valuable to try to learn to communicate kind of these scientific things in plain English. It's hard.
I think it's hugely important, and I think it's a win-win. And I'm very fortunate that I still do a little bit of clinical, but I do research as well. So I have a feet in both camps. But I think, And again, Helga, you may have a different view on it. This cellular basic science stuff that yourself and many of the international community do, it seems so far removed from those who are actually living with the condition right now. It seems so far removed from maybe something that may help them in the next 2 to 3 years of their life. So it can feel very distant and therefore not relevant. And I think that's why it's so lovely to hear you making sense of it so people can understand. But above all, I think what I feel people like yourself with basic scientists is giving people hope that we are still trying to find the answer, and but we are making progress. Yes, we may have several more questions that we need to ask. And I think the big thing we realize is Parkinson's is a far more complex condition than we ever thought it was. You know, now we've got 40 recognized symptoms instead of the 4 that I remember as an undergrad. But I think that it really, I think your work really, really gives people hope that there is boffins working out there, you know, trying to piece all this together and make sense of what is a really complex, unknown, uncharted territory, and really moving the science forward. And I think that's hugely motivational for a number of people who are out there the living with the condition. And that's just my take. I guess, Helga, you may say I'm bonkers.
No, I completely agree. And I also think, particularly with an area like this, where you're talking about stem cell work, gene work, there is in the general population, I think, a suspicion about it, a concern about it. And I think if you're able to explain it to the level that you have so well that it's understood, that then goes a long way to dispelling some of the suspicion, because I think a lot of that comes out to simply not understanding or not really knowing what's going on. So, you know, from that aspect as well, I think it's hugely important.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think a big part of maybe kind of public suspicion of science, and especially some of these things, like especially around stem cells, for example, is the not understanding. And, you know, I mean, from my perspective, you kind of, because we are so far removed from the patients in the clinic, right, doing this basic science, you have kind of a fine line to tread where we want people to be excited about what we're doing. I want people to have hope and see the value in our work, even though it's, you know, we're saying this isn't going to lead to a therapy for like 20 years or something. So I'm really, I want to make sure I'm not giving false promises or overselling or kind of misrepresenting the reality of it. And so, you know, that for, I suppose, for this kind of research is a really difficult line to tread. My main concern is usually that I'm boring people. I almost never tell people outside of work what I do, because you just kind of you see eyes glaze over and you're like, oh, I'm so sorry.
But I think you're absolutely right, isn't it, with research. And I think that's it. We don't want to give people false promise, but actually a really important finding from any research is that something doesn't work, because actually we can move on from that and say, okay, we tried that and that didn't show any hope, and we'll park that, and then we can put our energies on. So, but I think that is really important message to convey, that negative research findings and is equally important in terms of advancing, to think about the direction that we're going to go in. And I'm sure there's many frustrated scientists that have dedicated years of their life going down an avenue to go, no. But then I guess from a knowledge point of view, I think it's really interesting when we look at drug repurposing, you know, as an example. These are knowledge fields that people have developed over years and parked it. But actually that is now going back to thinking it didn't work for that condition, but maybe it will work for this condition. And I suppose your move from going from sort of tau and working in Huntington's, it's taking that expertise and your knowledge there and applying it in the Parkinson's field. So you could take it so far on one condition and then apply those skills elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, and even things you learn about how cells work and about particular processes, right? You know, kind of Helga mentioned that, you know, doing this podcast, you kind of have this overview and seeing how everything links together from kind of all these different researchers working in different fields. But I also kind of, you know, have a similar thing by working across these different neurodegenerative disorders, right? I mean, Huntington's and tauopathies and Parkinson's are all distinct things. They all have different proteins that accumulate. They all have different processes that are going on in the brain. But, you know, we can study all three of them using the same model systems, using the same tools, using the same knowledge, and one informs the other. So, you know, you'll be reading the literature about Alzheimer's disease. You're like, oh, I see something similar in my cells in the Parkinson's model. And then, you know, there's a lot of overlap between these things. And so it's really neat to kind of see how one field informs the other, and then they kind of catch up and kind of get a little bit of healthy competition going to like drive things forward as well, is always good.
Well, I've got one last question, if I may, and then Helga may have another one. So what excites you? What's the area of research that really excites you in the next sort of 5 years? And what, you know, what are your hopes and aspirations in terms of, in relation to your line of work?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, in terms of, you know, my work and what excites me is doing new things and kind of developing new tools. So, you know, I kind of mentioned that we do a lot of organoid work earlier. So, you know, we're developing kind of improved models so that they're more reliable, more reproducible, that we can do things on a larger scale. We're applying, you know, techniques that people have typically used in mouse models to study mouse brain to those organoids. So not only do we not need to work with mice, but we can study specifically a human system, which I think is very important. You know, I think we'll start to see as well a transition away from using so many mice for things like preclinical testing to using these human, more complex human models. And I think that's really important because a lot of the drug trials for all kinds of neurodegenerative diseases have cured millions of mice, but have not worked in people. So I'm really excited for the development of those technologies. And I'm excited to like kind of get these brand new things up and running that are hopefully going to be valuable, not just for us, but for other researchers in studying whichever brain disorder is their favorite. I just really want to be helpful, work with lots of different people, like have some exciting ideas, have a good time while doing some good science.
You are the unsung heroes, I have to say. You know, for people like me, you know, listening to you devoting your life's work and your job and your work and your time towards finding treatment, hopefully one day perhaps a cure for the disease that, you know, I'm suffering from, it's completely humbling.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you. You know, we, like I said, in basic science, we don't really have any interaction or engagement with actual patients or people with any of these disorders. So, you know, it's been a humbling experience to talk to people who are actually affected by the work that we're doing as well, because we're in a bubble away from people's responses as much as they're in a bubble away from what we're doing. So thank you very much. That's very, very kind of you.
Thank you so much. You know, this has been a really, really thought-provoking, but I think I think Helga's hit the nail on the head. It is the unsung heroes, that it's your cutting-edge science that really allows to build on it. And, you know, and I think that is so important. So, yeah, I think huge, huge thank you for all that you do and continue to do. And I think we're going to look forward to hearing the results of as your study as it progresses and all the other output from your lab over the next few years. So huge thank you for me.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm excited. You know, we're a young lab. We've only just started. This project has only just started in December. So there's really cool things to come.
Superb. Thank you.